I have a most interesting subject to discuss with you this morning. This is the Senior Minister of our Lord and Savior. When we were children in Sabbath school.
Hi, everybody. My name is Elliot Morgan. And I am here with the incomparable.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, I knew I was going to use that word, but I felt embarrassed to use it, so I tried to mask it in a bit. The name...
Oh, this is where I say my name.
Your name.
Oh, okay. My name is Peter Rollins.
Dr. Peter Rollins, everybody. Yeah. Round of applause. If I had time, I would add a round of applause,
on a sound effect.
Yeah. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, man. Good. I'm doing fantastic. I noticed that as soon as you turn this on, like, your whole kind of body shifts and a smile comes on your face.
Yes.
Like, this is you in your natural habitat.
Is it natural? I don't know. I think it might be.
You put yourself into a certain frame of mind.
Probably, yeah. It's a lot of I've been reading a lot of motivational Instagram posts that are making me, like, you hold yourself to... My mom sent me a TED Talk on body language. Which I had seen before, and then I rewatched, but it was about like the way you hold yourself and all that stuff. And then I was watching another thing by a guy named Jordan B. Peterson, old JBP. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about body language and his little thing. So I've been, and I
noticed. He's a controversial character.
He's so controversial.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Oh.
I don't know. Whatever. the stuff I see of him is not super controversial, but I guess he just does a bunch of like self-help, you know, like stuff that young men gravitate toward, which we'll be covering some of that stuff, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. He doesn't like postmodernism. That's a funny thing.
Yeah.
So I listen to some of his stuff. I enjoy kind of like, you know, being provoked by him and thinking through him, and also like some of what he says, but he hates the old postmodern kind of stuff. So,
which is so great, because I can't say I'm a huge fan of most of the postmodern stuff. So I definitely have an attraction to him for sure.
Yeah, and that is interesting because, like, for me, because that's what I did my PhD in. So it's for me,
Jordan B. Peterson,
yeah, in postmodernism, or it was called poststructuralism.
Yeah.
And so I have a purely philosophical understanding of it, but I think he's talking about it as a cultural,
yeah, very pragmatic.
Yeah,
like, this is how it's affecting us in a negative way, and like,
yeah,
that's interesting because you. So for those listening, Dr. Peter Rollins has a doctorate in something called post-structural theory, and I'm just now learning that that is synonymous with postmodernism.
Yeah, pretty much.
I had no idea. So when you used to say that, I'd be like, I don't know where the philosophy part comes from, because I don't know what post-structural... Okay, so that's what it is.
Yeah, well, because it's kind of like postmodernism became such a word that was used in pop culture, et cetera, et cetera. And so the more technical term was kind of post-structuralism, and that just made a differentiation. I mean, like, I'm not talking about what the kids are into.
Yeah.
We're not talking about Pokemon and...
Stand the test of time. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You're not going to be writing an article in like Reader's Digest about it or something.
No.
That's going to be related to that. So you did that. If for those who are brand new to this podcast, Pete and I...
Which is everybody.
Everyone.
Because this
including
is...
Including us.
Yeah, yeah. This is our first... Go
yeah, we've tried. This is the third time we've tried it. The first time there was a technical error, but we liked it. And the second time we just didn't. It was fine.
It's fine, but a couple of weeks passed because it was Christmas, and by the time we got back to it, it just felt old. You know.
So we are it's the Fundamentalists. This is the Fundamentalists podcast, and the way we talked about this before hitting record was that we were going to do some bios, explain kind of who we are. I think it's fun I'll try to explain as much as I know about you, and then you about me, right? That's kind of more fun, right? Because we did that one time.
Yeah,
that was nice. Okay, so Pete. Is a philosopher and a theologian. He's currently on tour with Rob Bell doing something called the Holy Shift Tour. And he has written a number of books, done a number of lectures, released a number of YouTube videos. And all of it centers on his particular work, which is, if I were to articulate myself, would be something along the lines of like a psychoanalytic approach to modern Christianity. You're involved in such movements as emerging Christianity, as well as more maybe scholarly areas. Like, you seem to be much more, you're an actual scholar in these areas. And as so you take these ideas and you incorporate them into what Christianity is, and then people gravitate toward it because, as psychoanalysis, it very much resonates with who people are, and so you do teachings in that vein.
Thank you. It's always lovely to hear what someone else says about you or how they understand what you do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm interested.
It's always interesting to hear how wrong somebody can be about you and make you wonder what did you do to give the impression that is what you do.
I like that person that you described.
I'm not, oh, really?
They sound kind of cool. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Like, psychoanalysis interests both of us. I mean, we both have interest in many of the same things.
Yes. Which we're going to get to in a second. I want to talk about this book because I have so many questions.
Because we're also, by the way, people might not know, we're also housemates.
We are, yes.
And so we often read the same books.
House used liberally, mates used very conservatively.
Yes.
We barely talk to each other.
Yeah.
We don't get along at all, and it's very tense.
Yeah, we live on separate ends of this very expansive apartment.
we do enjoy our apartment living for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's how we know. And then we got to know each other because I did a fan of yours, and I read your books years ago, and then talked about you on a YouTube video, and then that started a conversation. And then you were not in LA at that time, and then we got to know each other because really we got to know each other a lot because I was going through what's called a divorce, and so during that time it was like you and Joe Beretta were like the only two people that I was like just be like, yeah, here's everything, and then that helped a lot, and so you were very beneficial in my life for that. And then after that, I read your books after that experience, and I was like, oh, he has no idea what he's talking about.
Yeah, no, that is very true.
Yeah.
And you definitely know that now.
Yeah.
Well, Elliot, by the way, let me...
behind the curtain.
I want to introduce you to some of the people who are listening from kind of my audience.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello. Elliot Morgan's comedy. Is a comedy.
I am a comedy. My life
Elliot
is a comedy.
Morgan's life is a comedy. Elliot, well, initially a host on YouTube with SourceFed, then also comedian, who's just started an incredible venture, which is like taken on like huge kind of interest, called Valley Folk, which is kind of will be a YouTube based channel.
Yes.
But what I connect with Elliot about is his comedy is thoughtful. Elliot's interested in philosophy. He's interested in questions of life and how to live well. And so, you know, we end up having very good conversations and then became housemates. And I think this podcast is, we want to kind of reflect that by kind of talking about some of those issues. So instead of you having your, you know, doing the comedy stuff, hosting, this is like late night with Elliot Morgan and Peter Rollins.
Yeah, that's the goal. Yeah. And I think that also will benefit like, kind of not benefit, but it shows both of us aside, because like you're drinking, what is this, a gin and tonic?
I'm drinking gin and tonic, and you're drinking
we don't need to talk about that. It's an Evan Williams whiskey.
Oh, I don't even, is that bad?
It's not bad. I actually love Evan Williams, but it's definitely not like
it's not top label.
Yeah,
top
I'm, label I'm supposed to say something like, if I'm gonna be drinking bourbon, which I'm a Scotch person, I should be saying like Bullet or like Woodford Reserve or some of that crap, but I have no problem with Evan Williams. It's like $10.
I'm drinking actually a really nice gin that a friend sent from Australia called the Gin of Life.
Oh, the Gin of Life.
Gin of Life.
Cool.
It's beautiful. It's really, really tasty. There's two. There's Gin of Death, and it's black, and there's the Gin of Life.
You gave me a sip of the Gin of Death, which was awesome. I just finished up, because this whole Valley Folk thing happened, I just finished up that bottle of Blue Label that I had, which was... admittedly, it was gone too quickly, but it was real good.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try to get another bottle of that real soon once the Valley Folk actually launches. Fair anyway.
Cool. So in terms of what you do, because you have a lot of hats, I mean, where does this podcast fit with you? Like, what does this add to all of the things you're juggling at the moment?
It's very difficult for me to, this is like the equivalent of like the nerd thing for me. Like, it's that outlet. It's like, I can bring up in whether it's whatever stand up or whatever, all the stuff that I enjoy talking to you about and we have these conversations about, but nobody wants to really hear it. And it's like, it's just an interest for me. It's very much just like, this is the stuff that you talk about and the stuff that, you know, even all of like everything, like, cause we're going to talk about capitalism in a second. Cause we want to start light
through it. Yeah. Go in the deep
and all that stuff. Like I enjoy it a lot. And I think that there's such value in conversations about it. And there's so few, because it's like, they're very niche. And what I like about the idea of us doing this podcast is I want to jump all over. Like I want to jump, like I want to talk about capitalism, but I also want to talk about, like, you know, women, because I don't understand them.
I've seen how you interact with women.
And I am sorry for you, for them. But yeah, like jump all over. And I think that it's an opportunity for me to kind of like release that. It's a release valve. What about you?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the same as it's the informality of this, you know, a lot of my work, you're kind of doing book studies or I'm kind of like, you know, it's very formal. Mm-hmm. And I just love the idea. Like we're sitting here, it's a Friday evening, we're having a drink on our sofa, and just talking about the books that we like, the kind of ideas that we're thinking about.
I know. And now I'm relaxing. Okay. It's happening now. Yeah, right now. Relaxed.
Oh, good.
That was a solid 20 minutes of bullshit. So, but now I feel, once you said that, I was like, okay, I'm good.
This is it. We're going to relax. We're going to talk about issues. And I mean, whenever you first suggested this, I think you were the one who kind of came up with the idea. It was like, oh yeah, a space to talk about, you know, what does it mean to live well? You know, to use philosophy to kind of begin to kind of look at that and you know, what does it mean to live well in relationships and in friendships and family life? What does it mean to make a life that is well lived?
I was talking to somebody and like there is one thing that I've found to be very exciting about life. And a lot of it is like, I find it's very common in girls to be kind of like into self-help type stuff and to be into like self-improvement and self-growth and all that good stuff. But I've enjoyed in the process of like therapy, which I'm sure we'll talk ad nauseum about, but like the constant, as soon as I'm like, oh, okay, I get it. As soon as I'm like, okay, yeah. I should be honest all the time. Okay, great. And then I'm like, oh no, there's something beyond that. There's like wisdom beyond that. And then beyond wisdom, there's like another like aerial view of seeing life. And there's always just this next level. And I like that a lot. I think it's really fun.
Yeah.
But I also enjoy like, I'll do like the meditating thing. Not all the time, but I'll do it sometimes. But you don't do that at all. Cause you're going to hell.
If I meditate, I just fall asleep. That's just, you know, me and my naps. So.
That's called an obstacle, man. I'll connect you with my lady.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to do it over the phone. You're going to telepathically.
Do you have a lady who helps you meditate?
Yeah. I mean, she's a specter.
Oh.
But, no, I don't have a lady.
Is she an app? I thought you had an app or
it's
something.
Siri. I have an app. Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay.
Insight Timer. Yeah.
I thought it was a woman who maybe speaks to you in the app. She kind of like tell you to clear your mind.
Whoa, that'd be crazy. That'd be creepy.
Is like, that right?
Yeah, okay. If you could just connect with somebody.
But you know, there's that thing. What's that whisper therapy?
Oh, AMSR or something.
Something like that.
Where ASMR.
Like, is that what it's ASMR?
ASMR, yeah.
ASMR. Yeah, maybe you could try that. Maybe this feels a little bit like that. I feel like I'm very relaxed almost.
You are very relaxed. Yeah, your posture is definitely... Pete is almost horizontal in his chair right now. Very, so we came up with the title Fundamentalists. We were having tiki drinks at Tiki Now.
Yep.
Humble brag.
Yeah.
And we were outside. I was partaking in a bad habit, which I've since given up.
That's right, you have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was called smoking cigarettes. I stopped, but I also didn't do it for long. But anyway, we're out there and I was being a horrible person by doing that. And we started talking about titles. And the original title that we were going to go with was Nothing Matters. It's by the Nothing Matters podcast, which is a nice thought.
Which I loved the play on words there, because kind of the idea was we were going to talk about how embracing the nothing is something that matters. So a lot of our stuff would be around embracing our traumas and looking at the difficult stuff in life and the things that we try to run from. And so it was like matters of the nothing, but also a kind of fun conversation.
Yeah.
So I kind of thought it worked quite well. It just didn't sound that great.
It didn't. Yeah. And it sounded, I think, it would have been, I like the Fundamentalists. And then we landed on that because of a bunch of other crap, but anyway, I'm happy about it. We'll see what happens. We got to figure out this logo situation.
Oh yeah, we need a logo.
We have no idea how to do this. So if the audio is off or loud or too quiet or something, I'm so sorry. And please let me know and I'll work to fix it and we'll figure it out. So I'm reading this book. It's called Capitalism and Desire. Am I not supposed to be a Republican?
well, That's an interest. What would Todd McGowan say?
Todd McGowan would say probably it's fine being a Republican would be my guess, because you, as long as it's about, it's not about the, I don't know. I'm not that far into the book, but I feel like it's very heady, and I'm learning a lot, and it's summarizing a lot of Freud stuff. But I have no idea. I always hear people, especially in Los Angeles, who are like very, for lack of a better word, woke, and they become very like anti-capitalist and very revolutionary. Mm-hmm. And I have a buddy of mine who I love very much. His name is Jarrett. I know he is very anti-capitalist, but I've never understood why. And so I would always be like I'd have kind of an idea and be like, oh, it makes you work and makes you greedy or whatever. But there's never been any way for me to articulate why the system that we're in is bad. And I could never articulate why it felt so unpatriotic to feel that way. Like it felt always like the moment I say I don't like capitalism, it's like spitting on the American flag or something. Like it's some kind of horrible thing. But then McGowan is like, no, capitalism is not a culture. Culture is it like capitalism is in all sorts of different types of cultures of varying levels of whatever. And the culture is where you get identity, but you don't get your identity from the, economical system or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, coming from Europe, Marxism and capitalism and those conversations are much more in the air throughout university.
Really?
Less so in America.
Yeah, we don't talk. We're like,
Yeah, I mean, if you do a degree in the UK, you know, you can't not, for example, read Marx. If you're doing a humanities degree, you're gonna read, and you're gonna read a lot of that kind of literature. So, but I know in America, because of your history, that's. Like words like socialism or Marxism are.
Oh yeah, no, you're done.
Seems very negative. Yeah.
It ends a conversation.
Yeah,
but then it starts talking about like the effects of capitalism, and it seems like so many of the things that I feel like people are harping on in today's culture are very much. And correct me if I'm wrong, because I very well could be, but many of them seem to be a result of being in a very capitalist society. Like it was freaking me out when he was talking about like even the idea of a revolution plays into the capitalist promise, because it says, oh, if we have this big revolution and when we usurp the system in the future, we'll have the satisfaction that we crave, and it's just making that a commodity. It's making
absolutely. And the book is called Capitalism and Desire, because he's not, in one sense, he's not directly being anti-capitalist. What he's asking himself, he's asking the question, how does desire function in a capitalist society? How do we desire? So people used to critique capitalism because of inequality. That was the first wave of critique.
Yeah.
The second wave of critique was in terms of how it potentially made us into one-dimensional figures, where we gave ourselves over to jobs that we weren't invested in, where we were like cogs in the wheel of a larger system.
Breaking the human spirit kind of deal.
And that was very big in the 60s. But
tied to, according to him, a sexual thing. He said that the early Freud being all into repressed sexual desires played into this 1960s kind of anti-capitalist revolution, because there's also a sexual revolution happening at the same time. And they thought, I don't know anything about the 60s, but like it was something about like if they break free of the capitalist thing, so too the sexually repressed desires will come forth, and it'll be this like society of love and happiness and all that crap.
That's right. There is something, there is a lot of truth in this, but a lot of theorists are saying that capitalism can have this very repressive dimension. So, you know, you have to get up at a certain time, go to a job, you have to obey certain, you know, that there's just a lot of repression. And so the sexual revolution was seen as a political revolution, because if you could free yourself from your repressions and be sexually and be honest with your desires.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
Let me stop you right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to keep what I got going on locked way down.
Yes. Yeah. Keep that stuff way down.
I had a thought about, okay, so whatever about all this stuff. The reason I'm bringing it up the reason I'm so interesting.
That's a good Freudian slip.
Yeah, right. The reason though I am into it is because like I see it in a lot of people and in my life particularly. And like I've noticed that I grew up, my parents owned a small business, and there's the issue of retirement happening And it's like my one parent is wanting the other parent to retire, but the other parent isn't wanting to retire because they want to get to X, Y, and Z. And when they get to X, Y, and Z, then they'll be able to retire. And maybe if they retire, then they won't fully retire. And then, but then they also just bought like a really nice, second home. And yeah. So, but they're like, if we could get maybe a different second home than this other second home and kind of upgrade the second home, then, you know, and I'm like, something's going on here, yeah. You know? And I've also noticed that growing up, because there was always sort of this, like, we just want this on this, you know, but they want that small house on the canal, never the mansion. Mm. They're always adamant about that. But I was like, there's something where it's always just a little bit more, even in the kind of like aspirations. It was always like, we just want a small house on this thing, but it was constant. And it was, and so I'm like, I look at them now and I'm like, well, there's some effect that's been had on them as a result of working in this small business thing and striving and like toiling. And I think it's beautiful. Yeah. And I think it's incredible. And I learn from it, but like, I don't know. That's why that's what attracts me to the conversation about capitalism, is this constant need that I see that people have, where it's like,
to just get that little bit more that might answer it. Yeah, and that's Todd McGowan's. This is the third wave of critique. And it's a very simple thing for him. It's going like, well, there's something about, with it, we always think there's something just ahead, and self-help plays into this, to be honest. If only I do X, Y, or Z, I can be the type of person, dude. You know, I want to be.
It was blowing my mind. The minimalist movement is one in which it's like, just clear everything out. All you're doing is making space a commodity. Like, you're just making, like, if you throw everything out, then you're going to be happy. If you get really organized, then you're going to be happy and like all that crap. And it's like, no, do you not see that you're just buying into another religion or whatever?
Absolutely. We can make anything into an object that's desirable for, oh, that will take away my anxiety. Mm-hmm. That will alleviate the suffering. And yeah, Todd McGowan in the book, he's kind of arguing that mentality is deeply embedded in our society, and it's actually something that is destructive, because there's always an object that will take away our anxiety, make everything better. But Todd McGowan, who's trained psychoanalytically, he's saying, well, no, that anxiety, it's like someone's got insomnia, right? The room is rarely black enough and the room is rarely quiet enough that they can sleep. There's mm-hmm. always like some tiny noise. Maybe it's the fridge or maybe it's a creak. Mm-hmm. It's like you're looking for something to attach on, and there's always just, if only it was a little bit quieter, a mm-hmm. little bit darker. Whereas of course the challenge is how to sleep in a room that's not perfectly dark or perfectly quiet, rather than try to create a world where everything's perfect.
And I'm not saying it's this way with people who are insomniacs, but like, the metaphor, if you were to like follow the metaphor, and it would fall apart, because I don't know, this is how I'm, don't suffer from insomnia. Well, I'm a light sleeper, but that's different. But is there something to be said for like the idea that if they are always unable to detach from whatever noise that is, that they're gaining satisfaction from their inability to sleep, or they're gaining satisfaction out of knowing that if that one thing went away, like, is that, because my understanding was that the Freud saying that satisfaction is more important to a human being than pleasure means that the person who is at the job, who hates their job, gains satisfaction out of knowing that they could, that they're worth more elsewhere.
Yeah. I mean, that's the big question that Todd McGowan asks it in this book, it sounds weird when you first hear it, but is, what are you enjoying out of your lack of enjoyment? What do you get out of your suffering?
It sounds like phooey. It does sound like, it sounds like absolute, it sounds silly.
It sounds silly initially, absolutely.
It's like, this has a bunch of, like, it sounds like a little bullshitty. Yeah. But then you're like, oh no, that actually, it tracks.
It tracks. Yeah, like for example, like a hypochondriac, you know, they have a sense of, I've got a disease. And they're fantasizing about disease, and they do want the disease. There's nothing in them that wants the disease. But you have to ask psychoanalytically, well, what are you getting out of, what enjoyment are you getting out of imagining that you have cancer?
Because
you kind of go, there must be something. And what often one discovers is the hypochondriac has a deep anxiety. And so the disease that they fantasize about helps them put that anxiety onto that. Oh, that's the problem.
Yeah.
So even though the hypochondriac is like in suffering, there's something that's being got out of the suffering. So it's always trying to find out, what do I get out of
crazy.
My lack of my suffering? Yeah.
I like it, man. I like it.
Yeah. I mean, the old gambler thing's interesting because people think that gamblers are addicted to winning, but often gamblers are addicted to losing.
Yeah.
Because if you won the slot machines all the time, you just realize, oh, this isn't that great. It's not a great way to make money. It's not that fun. But by continually losing, the person can have the fantasy that winning would be amazing, that winning would sort everything out. So that I mean, fantasy is...
Because the counter-argument, I would just say, if I was talking about a gambler, I would be like, well, no, it's just that because winning is so rare, it makes it all the more special.
Mm. But that clicks into it. Because of its rarity, it becomes a phantasmic object.
Yeah.
So, if you kept winning the slot machine, the fascination would disappear very quickly. But when it's something that you rarely get, it can take on like a kind of a salvation type fantasy.
So, okay, I'm going to go real heady on you here. This is real. I'm too dumb to be asking the questions that I'm asking. And I hate, I don't mean for this to be a Q&A either.
Oh, yeah, no.
But you fell asleep. You fell asleep earlier.
Yeah.
And first of all, how dare you?
Yeah.
But we were about to, like, I don't care at all, but we were about to, you were like, I'm going to be out there. And I sent some text that was me being jokey, but it was something about time being a commodity that you believe in the promise of or something like that. And then I thought about it. I was like, well, wouldn't time be the ultimate commodity or the only commodity or like the only thing that you can't get back? So there's no reciprocity. Like, and this is real like freshman college crap, but like, a laborer.
Are we all in the Matrix? Is that what you're asking?
No, that was me. That was me last year, but I was heavy into that crap. I was like, no, for sure it's a simulation. For sure. If you look at the graph of how fast and if we are, great. I'm totally fine with that. But I think the simulation would have been cooler. But anyway, what do you think about time?
What do I think about time? So you're saying that because time... Or what do you mean is that time is...
You're paid for your time. You're given $10 for an hour.
Yeah.
We made up an hour. And we believe that time, there's a past, present, and future. And the whole idea of capitalism is kind of the promise of the future.
Yeah.
So inherently, there's like a time thing associated with it. So it's in the future, I'm going to figure out how to do it. In the future, I'm going to work out. In the future, I'm going to do all these things. Is there any connection there? Or is it total bull? I could be... totally full of shit right now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, and there's a futurality.
We've discovered something. I'm going to write my book. This is my thing.
This feels like, you know, we should be smoking weed or something.
Oh, a lot. Yeah. Well, it just got legalized. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a futurality to capitalism. That's what Todd McGowan's saying, is that it's always something just over the hill that if we can get, then everything would be great.
Netflix comedy special.
And it's always receding. It's always...
Sitcom.
What's that?
Sitcom.
What's a sitcom? What do you mean?
Situational. For me, it'd be a sitcom or a Netflix comedy special.
What would be?
The thing that makes me happy. That's just around the corner.
Oh, right. Oh, I thought you meant watching one or something. Yeah. Actually being
or like being in love.
Yeah.
That would be another one.
We've talked about this, but like we know people who have been very successful, got their dreams, who have had a very precise dream. I know one friend who wanted to be kind of like a top Hollywood actor, and he landed his first top Hollywood role, starring role, and he said it was the most depressing day of his life.
Yeah.
And, you know, that almost sounds like if you wrote that down, you couldn't write that in the book because it's so obvious.
Yeah.
But actually, it's very true that when you have a dream that you think, oh, that will make everything great, it doesn't just not work. It actually is terrible when you get it.
Dude.
Because you realize the anxiety doesn't go away.
It's the same thing with the Valley Folk thing where it was like, that took forever. Mm. I mean, you were there, you saw, it was like, I think we're gonna release it this week. And then it happens and we're all like terrified. But I knew, I was like, the thing that is almost like, I'd hate for this thing to like just horribly fail, but there would almost be a relief in that because I would be like, okay, now we know.
Yeah.
And then it just blew up and it was 4 days later that we were all having like a knockdown, drag out argument. And I think it was just a level of anxiety on everybody's part that was peaking. And it was a result of something very good happening where it was like, oh my God, we get a second chance at this thing. And like, that should be the greatest thing in the world. For those who are listening, I launched a thing where with people who I've worked with for many years, but we stopped working together for a few years. And then we came back together to start our own thing, which was owned by all of us. And which is great. And it was, the response was incredible, but absolutely it resulted in that sort of just like, oh crap. Like we got, first of all, just nervousness, but also just this, like, shouldn't we be relieved? And instead it was just like, oh, this immense pressure, which we're joking about and being very transparent about, but it's a very real thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's an old theological idea of like, called providence, where if everything goes right, you know, the idea, you know, that God's going to make sure everything goes right. And then, you know, everything will be wonderful. Your enemies are destroyed, your family are healthy, et cetera, et cetera. But then the other side of that is if you have anxiety in life, it doesn't matter how perfect everything is. It wouldn't actually make you good. Like, it wouldn't make you feel good. And that Tillich said that if you're full of guilt, the rustling of leaves is terrifying, which means that when you've got internal problems, even if your external life is going perfectly, it doesn't get rid of the anxiety. But then the other alternative is you go right to the end and you say, well, real providence is in sense when the world's not okay, but you're okay with that. That's the real challenge.
Yeah, I remember when my life was not going great 4 years ago or something like that, and I was very quietly unhappy, and I was flying a lot. It was a season where I was just going back and forth, and I had a lot of darkness going on and all that crap. And I remember any time there was turbulence, just being terrified. Like I wasn't shaking or anything, but I was like nervous. I was like, I don't want to go down. And my thought was always just like, there's something wrong. And I was like, I can't die like this. Like, this is all messed up. And then now if there's turbulence on the plane, I'm like, well, great, like whatever. There's no, but it's all, I assume that's because there's the lack of anxiety.
Because your anxiety, like an anxiety is a universal thing in philosophy. Like anxiety is part of being human. Anxiety simply means the fear of nothingness, which is like lack, the fear of death or the fear of meaninglessness, the fear, the kind of sense of not living up to something. So anxiety is just this sense in which you're not the type of person you want to be, or you don't have what you want to have, or you won't exist forever. Mm-hmm. And we try to defend ourselves against it by creating a perfect life, by having some object that will fix us. But actually the real challenge is to accept the anxiety.
No, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
I'm just not going to.
Yep.
I appreciate you saying that, but I like my anxiety and I'm going to hold on to it.
Yeah. Well, that's the point, actually. The point is, like, enjoy your symptom, enjoy your anxiety.
I'm a unique, special sunflower. So, everybody, we have a sponsor.
Oh, yes.
We have to do a sponsored spot on our first. We don't have to. Okay, so here's the deal, everyone. The Fundamentalists podcast is brought to you by a sponsor, because as people who like to critique capitalism, we also believe in engaging in it. And so if you would like to help us out, you can go to trywink.com. That's TRYWINC. WINC. Get it? Not WINK. It's wink. trywink.com/thefundamentalists, and you will get $25 off your first order. It's a wine company. TryWink is a monthly wine subscription, but you can just order wine, like a shipment of it. And we have some on the way. I've used them for a very long time. And what they'll do is you can do a quiz where you answer questions like, what, you know, how do you like your coffee? What kind of desserts do you like? And they'll take your palate, more or less, and they'll give you a bunch of suggestions for wines, and then you order them and you're guaranteed to like them. They also come with these little cute cards that give you like food pairings and stuff. I wish these were talking points, but I actually just love them so much that I know all of that, and that's all I have to say.
Wow.
And if you go, it helps support the podcast and we can get better equipment, and that's about the end.
Oh yeah,
because we're doing this on two mics and a Zoom I got off Craigslist.
I mean, it is funny because alcohol is one of the ways that people try to avoid confronting their anxiety.
Yeah.
So it's funny that you just in the middle of talking about anxiety, you give a shout out for the wine.
Yeah. on that note, that yeah,
like, that's why, like, that's why Nietzsche was straight edge. Nietzsche was like, he didn't like religion or alcohol because he said they both were these attempts to run away from the difficulties of your existence.
Whatever, nerd. Like, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, that's like, don't, when people try to group in, like, things that are cool and fun with things that aren't, and try to be like, well, it's all the same thing. I'm like, no, it's not.
Yeah.
Alcohol's not like religion.
Alcohol can get, like, well, I think they're similar in the sense of, like, there's a positive as well. Like, religion at its worst shores up your anxiety, says everything's going to be okay. But religion at its best can draw you into it.
I think religion at its worst kills people.
Well, yeah, that's probably true. And the same with alcohol. And real alcohol is worse. Both kills people, and also people get drunk to escape their problems.
Alcohol doesn't kill people. People kill people. The Second Amendment grants me the right to have as much alcohol in this house as I want.
That, well, and you do, and you take full advantage of that from the looks of it.
I actually do. Yeah.
But alcohol at its best, having a couple of drinks, actually helps you talk about your life and what's going on and all of that.
It's the best.
Yeah.
It is the best. I've done some drugs.
Yeah.
I've done a few. And alcohol is
one of your favorites.
It's one of my favorites. Yeah. It's up there with meth and heroin.
Yeah.
But no, I enjoy a nice drink, but it does get, you know.
Yeah. But I think it's about how it's used. I do, like anything, I mean, in the sense that, you know, fire can cook food or you can, you know, burn yourself. So it's how you use it.
Yeah,
I think the Irish have a healthy and unhealthy relationship to alcohol. At its best, we like to have a drink and chat. It's our, you know, equivalent of Starbucks or bars. But at its worst, you know, you'll always have people who are like binge drinking because
I think America is like a buckle up. America's relationship with alcohol is like how you would treat a friend who you're always like, who's so much fun, but just like, it's going to get too crazy. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that in Ireland, it's more like a family member that like you're going to have just such good talks with. There's like a beauty in it, and there's like an intimacy, but you also just, it's tied to you so closely because of the culture. That's my take on it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
Did you like that?
I did. And I think in America, there has been a thing around prohibition in America. Well, obviously there was the prohibition, and then you can't drink till you're 21. And there's a lot of things about, you know, alcohol is, it's almost like it's something that dangerous and bad. And the more you have that, the more people want to transgress the prohibition. The more you say alcohol you can't have, the more you want it. So 18, 19, 20 year olds go crazy, get drunk.
I know, it's really bad. They need to lower it.
Yeah. Whereas if it's not a big deal, like my parents used to buy me alcohol when I was like in my teens because I couldn't go into the shop. Mm-hmm. But because they were like, yeah, buy him and his friends a few beers and they'll sit in the house, they'll listen to music. But if we prohibit it, they'll be outside on the streets getting some crazy guy to go in and get the booze, getting really drunk, throwing up.
You're crazy how stupid kids are.
Yeah. And I was number three. And so they were very strict with the first kid, my brother James, and he was the wildest. And then with my sister, they were pretty strict with her, and she was wild. And then by the time it came to me, they didn't give a shit.
Yeah,
and
it was the youngest.
And I was like super chilled out because there was no kind of, you cannot do this, you can't.
Well, that's good. You benefited from that, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, that was great.
Now, as the youngest, do you feel that all of those, like, I'm the youngest charts line up for you? Do you have that kind of?
I don't know those charts. I've heard that there are these charts, but I've never seen them.
A lot of thought goes into it. It's just one more thing like that because you might as well be like, you know, it's a Myers-Briggs type of thing where this matches up with me. Holy crap. What's your Myers-Briggs? Do you know what your Myers-Briggs
is? See, I'm kind of like not a huge fan of those. Yeah. Those kind of Enneagrams, Myers-Briggs.
You don't like horoscopes that have been repackaged
into pseudoscience. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Jung, who obviously the Myers-Briggs is based on, you know, I quite like some of Jung's early work, and actually the Myers-Briggs is probably the least bad of them all. So I'm sure it's pretty good. And I know people swear by it.
Probably the least bad, yeah.
Yeah. I'm just not that interested in myself. I mean, that's genuinely part of it. It's like, I don't know if I'm that interested in what type of personality I am.
Oh, yeah, I don't have that.
All right.
I have that. I've noticed that you, we'll do a thing where like, we're both dudes and we'll head out, we'll grab a drink or whatever. And we have mirrors outside of the elevator and I'll look in the mirror to check my hair. Always. Especially if we're about to go out, you don't look.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think you,
I don't know if I knew there was
mirrors. Do you look
there?
Yourself in the mirror? Have you looked, have you seen you?
Listen, you know, I had a thing where whenever I started doing videos and then I saw the videos and I was like, is that what I look like? Like, I wouldn't let that person
like a
near anybody.
Question.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like my hair was mad and yeah. I was like, yeah, now obviously I looked in mirrors, but it was funny the first, I'm sure everyone gets this, the first time if you see yourself in a video, you do suddenly go, oh my goodness, like
yep.
You're seeing yourself from outside of yourself and mm-hmm. that was a bit bizarre. So I've tried to neaten up since then.
You're working out, you're exercising?
Yeah, I'm doing a little bit of that, not mm-hmm. much. I straightened my teeth. I mean, I come from in Ireland. Like I had the European teeth, and I didn't even think anything about it until I came to America. And then you had perfect teeth. Well, yeah. Then I did Invisalign. We should be sponsored by Invisalign, my
I'm sure we should be.
They 22 in braces, and I'm really glad I did. I'm really glad I straightened my teeth. But here's the bizarre thing in Ireland. I mean, people like, you know, a lot of people have good teeth, but if you have a bit of a wonky teeth, it's not noticeable at all. Nobody cares. And so when I came to America, it took a while, but after about 6 months, I started to go, oh, actually, I'm discontent with how my teeth are.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, that's annoying because I was never discontent before.
Yeah.
And then I had to spend $2,000 to kind of become content with what I was content with all the rest of my life.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird.
Well, but you're content now.
Well, I mean, with my teeth, you know.
Yeah. I'm sure there's some other version of Invisalign that like you can get for other parts of your body.
Yeah.
I'm trying to, I would like to get laser hair removal just in the bikini line. I'm trying to, you know, freshen up before the summer, but no, I want to get it before between my eyebrows and I want to get it.
Oh, do you have hair between
your
eyebrows?
If I let it go, if I were just let it go.
Would you have is it called a unibrow?
I wouldn't be allowed on camera. Like it would be.
Is that right?
It's bad. I think it might be after years of shaving it down and
getting
waxed.
See, that's the problem.
That's
the problem, man. It's probably was like there's hardly anything there, and you probably in one day.
Oh, absolutely.
Thingied, and then it suddenly was like, okay, we're gonna. He's fighting us here.
Yep.
And then they set up a rebellion.
Yep.
And now, if you didn't shave, you'd have a unibrow. Do you just do that? That would be amazing to see.
I could. I forget sometimes, and it starts growing in, and I'm like, oh no, he's coming out. This horrible person.
But this society, I mean, this is one of the things about LA that I've found, and you've heard me say this, but I have found it the most religious place in the world.
It's amazing.
Yeah,
it's absolutely the most religious thing.
I define religion in what promises certainty and satisfaction, what promises the object that will make you whole. And everywhere in LA, people are promising if you, you know, look the certain way or you have a certain amount of money, then you will be whole and complete.
Their comedy show gets enough people in it. And it's the minimalist thing, it's the kale thing, it's the eating clean, it's the yoga, it's constant.
It's constant trying to find this
object. I love
object.
All of it.
I know, and I it's fun being around.
I love it. I love the yoga. I love the meditation. It's just, but yeah, I mean, none of it's.
But there's always a next thing, like, you know, CrossFit or whatever. There's something that mm-hmm. was going to fix things. And actually the challenge of life, partly, I think, is how to actually accept ourselves. Like that, I was talking to my friend Barry Taylor. You know Barry Taylor. And
love him.
Yeah, he's a great guy. And he was.
My face lit up. I felt myself light up when I saw him here. The other day. I was like, Barry! Yeah. Like, it was such a pleasant surprise. I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He was giving a talk yesterday, and he was saying that, you know, in one sense that he is suspicious about how much any of us can really change. Very much. It's very, very hard to do. Maybe two or three times in our lives, we might go through a change. But actually, the real challenge of life is how do we accept ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
And then, and not in the kind of new age, I'll accept, but it's more kind of like you go, you know what? Life is difficult and I need to learn to live within that. And of course, if you're able to do that, you do start to change a little bit. You know, you do start to feel more comfortable in your own skin. But what you have in LA is a constant kind of like, no, you can accept yourself once you get to this point, once you get here. And then you're just unhappy.
Once your chakras are clear and once you're like, your apartment is like free of bad energy and yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
it sounds so stereotypical of LA to like refer to those things, but yeah, it is really a thing.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
The tyranny of happiness, you know, the tyranny that we, there's a certain way to be, certain clues to wear that we're having to pursue.
Well, let's change gears here for a moment, because we've talked a lot about the lack of happiness. Why don't we talk about some things, Pete, that are making us happy right now?
Yeah.
So I'm going to start.
Yeah.
I got my morning routine down pretty well. Okay. Yeah. I get up, I work out, I go into my shower, turn the shower on, turn the lights out, light a candle, and I play either Rainforest Sounds or soothing mood music on the Alexa thing.
Very nice.
And it's delightful. I have usually coffee in the shower that I get from downstairs, as you know. I enjoy that. Something else I've enjoyed recently, my car. I just started enjoying my car again. Mm-hmm. I love my car very much. I'm having a great time in it. I think being in Florida like made me forget about it. And I'm enjoying being busy. Has been nice recently.
Yeah.
What's making you happy? Tell me about what's making you happy, Pete.
What's making me happy? Well, yeah, I mean, I'm very much enjoying where I'm living. We're living in North Hollywood.
The North Hollywood.
What's that?
The North Hollywood.
The North Hollywood.
Sorry, we're bragging, everybody.
Yeah, we've made it. But yeah, no, I'm really enjoying just the calmness of my life at the moment. Like I really have been freed a lot from the idea that there's something that I need to get, you know, some project that I need to finish in order for everything to be fine. And I've been very much just, I love my work.
Yeah.
But not.
You do, to your credit. You absolutely, truly do. Yeah.
But and not where my work is going. Although, you know, it's fun whenever you publish something or whatever, but I guess just enjoy the work.
Yeah.
You know?
And you do work on it. I think that's, I know in a lot of like, there's suspicion in people, I think, who grew up in religious circles that anything that they buy is just going to be snake oil, or that it's a lie in some way. But I've seen firsthand the amount of work that you put into the stuff that you put out. I've never seen you take anything lightly that you are that you're doing. You may know what it is, like it's not going to stress you out, but you'll be like, you put in the hours and you make sure that it's very good.
Thank you. We both do things that we enjoy.
Yeah, you know, which is nice.
And I mean, the book you're reading is, Todd McGowan has I really love what he does. I feel like I'm in agreement with his basic premise, which is we cause a lot of misery to the people around us and to ourselves when we're always frantically pursuing the next thing that's going to fix everything.
Yep.
And it causes violence, it causes scapegoating, all sorts of human problems. And if we can just sit down and kind of face the difficulties and embrace life and all of its complexities and the problems that it throws at us, we can actually have a much more enjoyable type of life. So my work is actually trying to help people enter into that in their own way. So I mean, that's an enjoyable job.
I was just hoping you were going to say like the soaps that you have in there.
In my the bathroom.
Yeah, you got some dope soaps in there, dude.
That's right. Moulton Brown's an English company. I like every time I go.
Oh, I've had some of their stuff before. Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice. I like that. That's what I like their stuff.
Yeah, I was looking at that. What's the guy's name? I keep blanking on his name. It's like Brunicelli or something other.
I forget.
Designer. I don't know. It's definitely like a. As much as I would like to be free from like the capital, blah, 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 I love nice things.
Yeah.
And like, I'm always wanting all the nice things. You and I have talked very much about how we need to replace that gosh darn TV stand, because it's hideous.
Yeah, it is hideous, actually. The problem is, after you've lived with something for a couple of weeks, you don't see it anymore.
Yeah, and that's how we are with each other.
Yeah.
We just disappear into each other, into the surroundings. What are you reading right now?
What am I reading right now? I just finished reading The Courage to Be by Paul Tillich. Oh, I'm reading a great book by a woman called Alenka Supancheck called What Is
Five
Sex?
Love Languages.
Oh. Five Languages, yeah. Yeah. What Is Sex? Which is really a book about what is human subjectivity? What does it mean to be human?
Oh, God.
Yeah. So.
Now, okay, first of all, what The Courage to Be sounds like a self-help book. That sounds like the most... self-help.
It's interesting.
That's right up there with like, you're a badass or whatever that, which I've actually heard is good. But,
yeah, the courage to be is like a philosophical self-help, but it's very much a self-help in the sense of it's about the courage to face your anxiety. So for Tillich, it's like the courage to exist, the courage to be.
What if I run out of anxieties?
Well, that's a kind of, and anxiety is only what, I mean, not everybody suffers from anxiety, but. But
that's what it is.
What's that?
I should have more. I should definitely have, I don't know if I don't suffer from it, but I should have more.
Yeah, yeah. Well, not having any anxiety is itself incredibly oppressive. That's like psychosis. Some, you know, is psychotics don't generally.
Oh yeah, no, I totally have lots of anxiety.
Yeah, yeah. But for
I just start changing my answer to make me sound as normal as possible. Yeah, I got a normal amount of anxiety.
Keep moving the goalposts. Yeah. But yeah, well, for Tillich, it's universal in the sense of anxiety is simply the experience of like realizing that death and kind of lack of meaning and, you know, not living up to something are universal kind of human experiences. And he's just going like, instead of trying to run from them, how do we accept them? How do we kind of like bring them into the affirmation of life? So for example, he says, say you question everything, you question your religion and your politics. And
I do that. Yeah.
Yeah. But you find it very depressing. It's dark. It's difficult. Everything's falling apart.
No, I don't have that.
Yeah, well, yeah, but you know, if someone's in that place,
I can't imagine being anybody but me though. So this doesn't.
Oh yeah,
this is about me. So until the moment it's not me, I'm like, all right. Okay.
But
so
you have gone through all of that, you know, the breakdown of your life and you know relationships
total,
and
the total demolishing of my life.
Yeah, you know, we all go through.
I went through the stages. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, but you know, for Tillich, he's like, well, the answer is not to try to get beyond the questioning or anything like that, but to show that in the midst of your questioning about life and meaning, you're affirming life by questioning meaningfulness. You're showing that you have a concern for truth. You have a concern for authenticity. You have a concern for what does it mean to live well. And so all Tillich does is he says, you find someone who genuinely questions life, who genuinely pokes at things, and all you have to do is turn that negativity into a positivity and go, look how much you care about stuff. You know, most people just watch Netflix, right? Look how much you care about life that you'll ask these questions. And that's the courage to be for him. It's like, it's you take on your questioning.
What a nice, that's a beautiful sentiment.
Yeah, so instead of getting over your questioning, you positivize it, you enjoy it.
I was thinking about that with my lack of political, like, I'm not defined politically very well. And so I end up always defending whoever the other person is. You know, against. Yeah. And I was thinking about that with that. And then I was thinking about it in like relationships and then like, with the Valley Folk thing, we were going through a lot of things and I was just I realized that as we were making decisions, because none of us have ever done this before, I realized that like when there was the chance that the decision would not be made, I would get really upset. Like something in me like would snap because I was like, we have to make a decision. We have to make a decision because if we don't make a decision, you know, da, da, da. And then I was like, why? Cause everybody was kind of like, why don't you like relax? Like it's not that. And then later I was like, there's something, I was like, what's going on where I'm this obsessed with needing to make a decision. And then I was like, oh, I wonder if like, and then I started thinking, I was thinking about this freaking book. Mm-hmm. And I was like, if it is like that thing and it is that is it possible that I actually, my indecision, I love my indecision and I love the fact that I don't make decisions. And so mm-hmm. like my like turning of that is me knowing that. And what I thrive off of keeping, never having to commit to a political stance and never having to say what my actual religious stuff is.
Yeah.
And what do I get out of that?
Yeah. So yeah, what
but you're
what,
taking it saying, making it a positive thing.
Make it
on the
positive. Yeah. I mean, this, and sometimes people call it enjoying your symptom, which is like, so say you have indecision about politics.
That's called horniness.
Yeah. You kind of, what's that?
That's called horniness. Like, all right.
Yeah. Oh, enjoying your symptom. It's that you take that and you go, there's a real positivity to that. Like, so how can you, you know, make that into a stance that's actually beneficial to the people around you and to yourself? And so you acknowledge that and you take it on board and you find something useful to do with it.
Yeah. I was talking to, in so many words, I was talking to one of my partners about it. And I was like, it's good. I was like, the fact that like, there's something in me that's like, nope, this is how it's going to be. It's, and it, it, to whatever, you know, it's worked so far to get certain things done. But, yeah, the response, the ugliness of the response of like, no, we have to do it now. It was very like, yeah. It was such a weird emotional, cause I'm a very laid back person. And then, but the moment there's like somebody going, let's check with somebody else. Let's get some opinion. I'm like, no, like, we have to make it now. And they're like, oh, that's not good. But yeah, I'll figure it out.
Yeah.
It'll be good. This is what we're doing here. You called it nihilistic self-help, which is.
Yeah. I mean, there's a guy, do you know Viktor Frankl's work at all?
No, that sounds like a name you made up.
Yeah,
Viktor Frankl's work. Frankl.
Yeah, he.
What is
Viktor,
it?
Viktor Frankl. I Viktor suppose he Frankl? Sounds like a okay. Yeah, fictional Frankl character.
Yeah, definitely. So.
Yeah, no, he's an interesting guy. He wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning, and he developed. It's not really a big area of therapy, but it's called logotherapy. But his work is interesting, and he says that, like, when he works with people and individuals. He's always asks, like, what is meaningful in your life? Even in the midst of all the depression that someone might be facing, what is it that stops you killing yourself? So he would basically say, you know, what is it that stops you committing suicide? And he would find that...
I think it'll hurt really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe I think it's the part where it hurts.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's all it is. That's something, that's something to work with. But he said that underlying... All humans, there's a concern for the world in some way. There's some level of meaning that we get out of the world, and it's about bringing that to the surface and affirming it. So even if you're indecision or questioning or whatever, that can show that you believe in, you know, making the right decision. You believe in thinking things through. You believe in the importance of authenticity. And so Frankl would always be kind of trying to see what is your affirmation of life, even in the midst of the difficulties of your life.
Yeah, that reminds me, and I'm not saying it's the same thing, but it reminds me of a chapter in a book called The Road Less Traveled, which is my favorite book of all times by M. Scott Peck. And there's a chapter in it about a guy who like detaches entirely from the world around him and like grew up, you know, very religious and very Christian or whatever, and then turned away and was just like, I'm an atheist and I don't talk to anybody and I go on maybe a date a year and like I'm off the grid and all this crap. And then like he comes to find through a lot of therapy that basically the guy like has pent up all of this like belief in the beauty around him and like all because he was somehow unable to confront the fact that he found it beautiful and the fact that he like saw God and like the trees and saw God in the river and all that crap. It's not so mean to say all that crap. It's just a thing that's a tick. But it reminds me that because it basically came to find out that like, no, this guy who is this bitter atheist just believed in God so vehemently and ended up becoming a reverend. Yeah. I'm butchering the story a little bit, but
yeah, and you get the opposite. You get reverends who, you know, they don't believe, but they can't express that because their family would disagree with them, their congregation, and so
they see despair in the river and they see like a void in the trees and like the space. Like I love when I have friends and they'll be like, well, you know, at night when the stars are out, don't you just feel so small? And I'm like, no. I don't know. I mean, I definitely feel like it's so vast. And I feel like, if anything, I would go into like a more new agey kind of like, I feel like I'm part of it, but I wouldn't say, but I have friends who are like, they look at it and they're just like, oh, it makes them feel just like they're nothing. And I'm like, oh man, I can't imagine looking at that and being like, but I don't know. That's my rambling right now at the end of the podcast. But you were saying,
what was I saying?
I don't know.
All right. Just that. Oh yeah. Well, I mean that whole thing about the guy who didn't believe in God, but he really did. And then the alternative, which happens, but is it shows the other thing is that we often don't know what we believe. That's another big thing is that we live in a society where it's very much, you know, people talk about what they believe politically.
Oh, they love it.
Religiously. And we all do it. But there's a weird idea that maybe we actually don't really know what we believe.
No idea.
What we believe is, yeah.
Dude, I was thinking about like that little joke where like opinions are like assholes. Everyone has one. I think opinions are like cars because everyone has one. And also we judge them based off of it and we forget they're a human when our opinion is stuck next to their opinion and rush hour traffic, we no longer see them as a person. We only see them as the thing that they're in. So that's my take on opinions, my hot take.
That's good. I like that.
And if anybody's listening, I apologize at any point if I come off either incoherent or like I'm trying to sound smarter than I am. I am both of those. I'm both trying to sound smarter than I am and trying to keep up and trying to understand all this stuff, and also sometimes incoherent.
Yeah. And our opinions are often, as I say, like they hide, like in, for Freud, our consciousness is a defense mechanism protecting you from seeing what you believe. So you might say, oh, I love my mom, I think my mom's amazing, but you have these dreams where she's dying. And then you discover in your dreams that you're actually resentful of something that happened, but you don't know that. In fact, here's the weird thing. You can meet people who give gifts all the time and they're so nice to people. They're so nice to a particular person. But then you discover that actually they hate that person. So maybe they're looking after their sick father, but they're so good. They visit 3 times a week. They're always bringing stuff around. But then you look and you go, oh my goodness, they're almost like too kind. They're giving so much. And then you scratch beneath the surface and you realize that there's so much resentment and dislike. And what they're doing, because they're guilty about that, they hide it in being overly nice. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. It's a shock to find out that actually
we call that the South.
All right. Oh yeah.
Nice people in the South are very just like overly nice because they're
and
so
it can hide a dislike.
And some of them are just the sweetest people.
But
anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. But it shows that you know we can be so unaware of our own beliefs and feelings that and it only comes out in like migraines or bad backs or that's where the truth is.
I was, we talked about this. I had that long ass dream where I woke up and my first thought was like, I really don't want to tell my therapist about this dream because I was like, he was in it. And I was like, I don't want to have this conversation. And I learned from the dream that I definitely just didn't trust him. Like I had trust issues with him and wasn't telling him everything and explained it to him. And like he was untrustworthy in the dream. Mm-hmm. And he was like, how'd you feel about that? What, you know, what was your reaction when I did that? And I was like, I was really angry and I was really upset. And then he took that and then like related to all these other things that had happened in my life that highlighted areas of trust where people have, you know, done all these things. And I was like, oh shit.
Yeah.
I was like, I never would have thought about, like, I don't view things through the scope as narcissistic and as whatever as I can be. I don't view things through the scope of like typically like victimhood. And it was literally like, no, that you got kind of screwed over there. You got kind of screwed over here and you got screwed over here. And I was like, oh yeah, I did.
Yeah.
And there's like a little bit of indignation, but,
and it can take years to discover that, to discover your real feelings and beliefs and ideas. And, and that's why in therapy, they listen to dreams. Cause the idea is that your conscious self is, all about censorship. You're trying to create an image of yourself that you like because you have to hang out with yourself all the time and also that other people will like. But that in your dreams, things are a little bit more fast and loose and you can sometimes glimpse stuff. But also that's what the Freudian slip is. The Freudian slip is a mistake that is true. It's an
like
error
when I said
that
I thought I was interesting earlier.
What's that?
Like when I said interesting earlier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, every time you're going to visit your mom, you can't find the keys to your car. If that's only once, it's nothing. But if maybe that happens 4 or 5 times, you have to go, oh, actually, maybe I do want to go and see my mum.
Right? Yeah.
But you didn't know it. It's actually the truth was in your not being able to find the keys. So that's why it's good to listen to your symptoms, to watch. Like, do you on the way home sometimes take the wrong turning so that you don't go back to your house straight away? Maybe that's telling you that you don't want to go home. So
sometimes,
we have to be detectives.
Yeah, maybe.
Mm-hmm. But we have to be detectives to our own lives. We don't have to be, but it's actually useful if we treat our life as a crime scene with like hints.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, at what's going on.
And I'm the murderer.
Yeah, but and then you find out lots about yourself.
Yeah, I love it, man. I think that stuff's so fun. I do feel like there is, I will say, I can be critical of some of the things that you talk about in regard to psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. I'm only saying that as we begin this podcast, because as curious as I am about it, I do worry that there's a sense of like, and you've talked about this a little bit, we've had these conversations where it's like, I worry that this idea of the unconscious and this kind of Freudian whatever Which I had another thought that I want to bring up, but that it does the same thing, where it's like, well, it's just another way of viewing the world that can be kind of religious, where it's like, if you understand psychoanalysis, or you understand the unconscious, or you make the effort to understand your unconscious, that you're going to receive some sort of end goal, and you're going to receive it. But I've brought this up before, and you were like, no, it is a life of existing within the tension. And not knowing. So that's where I'm like, okay, that actually is different than the typical kind of religious fix. Because if you were to be like, oh, it's if you go to therapy and you go through psychoanalysis, then you're going to come out the other end and you're going to be this cured human being. And it's like, that never happens. But the people who do are they tend to be so much more interesting than people who don't.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, for me, good religion, good analysis, good kind of life is those rituals that we have that help us to accept our existence and be able to accept the full range of human emotions and all of that. So I think religion is healthy when it does that. Psychoanalysis is healthy when it does that. But whatever rituals you need, you might find at the poker table or the pub or the coffee shop or confessional.
Yeah, meditation, yoga.
Yeah, wherever you find it, but not the stuff that helps you run from your life, but actually helps you kind of like somehow live in the tension of life. I think that's useful. We as human beings need that.
Love it. So good. That concludes, everybody, our first episode of the Fundamentalists podcast. Do you have any final thoughts, Pete?
No, I'm just kind of excited that this is the kind of thing we want to do. Yeah. This is like,
you feel good? How do you feel?
Feeling good.
Yeah, me too.
How are you feeling?
I feel pretty good. I always worry about coming off like an asshole. Yeah. That is like a thing. I had a conversation with my buddy Mike earlier, and I was like, I think sometimes I can kind of like be an asshole, and he just burst out laughing. I was like, yeah, you got me.
I don't want to come across as like, this is some sort of kind of like intellectual kind of like one-upmanship or something, and you're trying to, I hope this comes across.
I know. I worry. I don't want to be the guy who's like, look how smart I am, because I can fall into that trap. But I just do love this. I do genuinely love this stuff. So it's like, and it's hard to like, there's so many versions of this conversation you can have. Like it's so great for me to be able to talk to you about this, because I know you know it so well, and it's also just rare to talk to somebody who knows anything in Los Angeles, in America, let alone Los Angeles, who knows or is interested in that type of thing. And so I like to cut through some of the introductory kind of questions and stuff.
Yeah,
but I don't know if that comes off. It can come off douchey too.
No, so, I just feel like you're giving yourselves a hard time, and you say, oh, in America, like some of the people who have most influenced my thinking have been kind of great American writers.
I guess I mean more LA, my culture of comedy and kind of like Hollywood. Yeah. It's hard to find somebody who's like, so what do you think about capitalism? But I mean, they're there, I'm friends with them. It's great.
Well, and what LA has is like incredible talent and creativity in the arts.
Oh,
and
it's
music.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's
I love it, man. Yeah. All right, guys. Thank you. Try wink.com/thefundamentalists if you'd like to get some wine.
And then we'll get some wine as well, won't we? So
wine.
We'll all, and people here listening to this will drink. Maybe this will be better if people are drinking wine.
I know. I'm sure. Yeah, and maybe it'll be better if we're drinking
wine.
Yes,
exactly. So maybe next week we'll have some wine to be drinking.
Yeah, that's the goal. And we'll tell you what kind it is. It'll be real fun, and we'll pimp it out again. All right, cool, man. Well, thank you so much.
Cheers.
It's been fun.